So we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for the release of My Baby Rides the Short Bus. We've been really excited to see this event happen. I think that it's obviously these are important subjects to talk about in general in the population in terms of how we're taking care of our youth, in terms of the education system, all of these things. But above and beyond that, I think it's important to be discussing all of these things from a left perspective, specifically a thoughtful perspective. So we're excited to be having this release here tonight. We're excited for this reading. Thank you all so much for coming. So a little more about Blue Stockings for those of you who don't know about Blue Stockings. We are a collectively operated, volunteer-powered bookstore, a feminist project, a radical project. We're also an activist center and have a fair trade cafe. I love it here. It's one of my favorite places in the city. I hope y'all love it too. We do have events almost every single night of the week. If you're interested in learning about our other events, you can sign up for our events calendar up front. We send out 2 emails a month with all of our events listed on there. And we also are going to pass around the donation bucket. We have a $5 suggested donation for all of our events that helps just cover some of the overhead costs here, helps us be able to have events that are open to the public absolutely every night. If you're in a position to make a donation, we really appreciate it. And if you're not, you're absolutely still welcome to be here. A little more about our readers tonight. I'll pass around the donation bucket.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our readers tonight, Jennifer Silverman, Sabrina Chepajev. I knew I was going to stumble on the name, sorry. Truce Ingram and Anne Holliday. Jennifer Silverman is a recovering journalist, mama of 2 rambunctious sons, agitator and co-editor of My Baby Rides the Short Bus. Her writing about mothering her sons with autism has appeared in Hit Mama and Off Our Backs, among others. She lives in Queens. Sabrina Chepajev, excuse me for stumbling on your name, is a freelance writer and editor. Her work has been featured in Adbusters, Gathering of the Tribes, Riff Rag, and Streetwise. Her full-length collection, Clitterature, has been featured in the International Museum of Women's online exhibition. Her first book, Live Through This on Creativity and Self-Destruction, was a Lambda Literary Award finalist. Charisse Ingram is the mother of 2 children with PDD diagnoses. She is a lifelong New Yorker who currently lives in the Bronx. And our last reader is going to be Anne Holliday, who is the author of 4 self-mocking autobiographies, No Touch Monkey and Other Travel Lessons Learned Too Late, The Big Rumpus, Job Hopper, and Derby Sugar Cookies, and the picture book, Always Lots of Hymies at the Zoo. In her spare time, she is the chief primatologist and sole staff member of the quarterly zine, The East Village Inky, as well as Bus Magazine's Mother Superior columnist. So please join me in welcoming Jennifer first and all the rest of our readers. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Too high. Okay, is this good?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming out on this soggy Saturday evening to celebrate the release of this book. I've been waiting to say a release of this book for 3 years, so it feels fantastic. I also love Blue Stockings, and they've always been supportive of my writing and very happy to have my family here. But in particular, I would like to thank Jeffrey Lewis in the back of the room. Who handed off my manuscript via email to PM Press, who published this book. So without that step, we might not be here tonight. So thank you again. Tonight I'm going to read from the foreword of this book, which was co-authored over email between myself and my co-editors who live in Seattle. And before that, I just wanted to say a little bit about my essay, my personal essay that's in this collection, which is about my now 11-year-old son, Luke, and my experiences raising him and his little brother. And Luke is autistic, his little brother is not. So it was about having a second child who was typically developing after having the first experience where it wasn't. But in the structure of the essay, I started off by talking about a conversation I had with a woman at this recreation program that we went to. And I say went because a few months after I wrote the essay, some bureaucrat decided that the funding would be better spent elsewhere, and we lost this service. And I bring this up because right now New York State is facing a 10% budget cut for services for the developmentally disabled. And especially coming from Governor Patterson, to me that's absolutely appalling. So you know, it's easy to Google this information and find out where to write to, but I really urge everybody to go ahead and do that. So off my soapbox. Almost 10 years ago, three moms, one of them would be me, met on an online community bulletin board for alternative parents. We were activists, but it wasn't for a few more years that we discovered the most defining thing we would have in common. We are the parents of disabled kids. Our lives came together over the internet and things changed. We all became parts of blended families as Yandra and Sarah became a couple, Jennifer remarried, and eventually became a parent of two. Throughout, the diagnosis, the symptoms, and the services kept rolling in. We talked to each other through advocating and strategizing, and we began to know a few things. When friends from the online community HitMama.com put together a conference in 2004, we offered a workshop on disabilities and parenting. In a window of this room, we chatted about what it felt like living with our kids while one of them obsessively watched the same movie for the 600th time, and the other flipped pell-mell through a phone book. Not a lot of other parents showed up, and most of them came only out of curiosity, not out of need. It didn't matter who showed up to the three of us, because for once we were subject, not object. We had pulled ourselves out of the cautionary tales about things that can go wrong with babies, out of isolation, and pulled ourselves together in the center of our own stories. We decided to put together a zine, and this book was born of our work. Raising a child with a disability brings a whole new level of isolation to alternative parents who do not fit into the mainstream through circumstance, identity, or choice, and who carefully consider the implications of our parenting. Disability forces us to reach back towards the mainstream while moving us irrevocably outside of it. We might have been planning to put our children in small alternative schools before we knew where they were disabled. And now, after the diagnosis, find ourselves fierce advocates of their inclusion in traditional classrooms. While we might have had home births planned, we may spend years in hospitals praying for the success of invasive medical procedures. While we might have fantasized about anarchist communes before our disabled babies entered our lives, we find ourselves lobbying the legislature for increases in funding to state bureaucracies. We, who had previously rejected the institutional structures of mainstream culture, or found ourselves on the margins to begin with, discovered that we are clinging to the slim hope that they will save us after all. We are remarkably absent from the public eye. When we are in the media, it's usually about a miracle cure that made some starlet's child more normal. Or there is the occasional story that spotlights a stereotypical American, white, middle-class, two-parent, heterosexual, family, showing off the gifts of a savant or highlighting a feel-good donation made to a poor, struggling family with special needs kids. At worst, our families are objects of ridicule in alternative and mainstream press sources. Take, for instance, Dennis Leary's 2008 book, Why We Suck, in which he stated that kids diagnosed with autism are just stupid or lazy, and their diagnoses are just for their parents who, quote, want an explanation for why their dumbass kids can't compete academically. Comments like this poke fun at the people in our society who are too visible for comfort, and they function to enforce invisibility. When your everyday experience only ruins a joke, you have to decide to stand out as both one of them and humorless, or blend into the wallpaper of a mythical normalcy. These stories erase completely the reality that all children learn at varying rates, making our complex reality a bummer of a laugh kill. As parents of differently abled children, we are often put on pedestals. People wonder in awe how we cope, or hand us platitudes about how we have landed in a different but wonderful country where we simply need to dream new dreams for our special angel children. But when out in public, our special angel children are most often stared at and treated like enigmas. Our children are inconvenient, awkward, and difficult. Their parents, even those of us with a lot of tattoos, are usually struggling mightily to be less obtrusive. Those who wonder aloud how we do it are really highlighting for themselves and us that they will never have to. The truth is that our kids aren't angels. They're people with big challenges, and their challenges make our lives as parents incredibly complicated, messy, and sometimes heartbreaking, no matter how much we love them. As parents who are already marginalized by politics, sexual orientation, gender, race, or ethnicity, parenting philosophy, our own disabilities, economic status, blue hair, piercings, or something else that makes us unlike the camera-friendly special needs family America knows and adores, it can be harder to find support among other parents or be taken seriously by the teachers, therapists, and other professionals on whom we often have to rely on to get the services that our kids need. When we three parents made the leap of taking a small zine and turning it into an anthology, we strove to make the voices represented as inclusive as possible in terms of diversity, class, gender, race, and struggle, to distinguish this project from others. Part of valuing that diversity included working to preserve the authenticity of the work of the authors, including valuing voice over grammatical convention from time to time. So you'll see that when you read it. As is the nature of anthologies, there is a submission process for accepting pieces, and we extended our deadline twice to encourage a wide range of writers to contribute. On many levels, we have succeeded. The contributors here range from a Burmese mother overcoming her own physical disability as she works through her son's challenges, to a lesbian minister who becomes a foster parent and advocate of a developmentally delayed teenager not much younger than she is, and a quirky single mama who quits school at the age of 16, yet successfully took on her son's school system to find an accessible placement that accommodated his cerebral palsy. Still, the racial and cultural diversity of the writers may not be immediately apparent to the reader, as some writers considered race and culture central to their story, and some did not mention their backgrounds. Statistically, the overwhelmingly female voice in this book makes sense. We have 2 men out of like 36 essays and poems. Numerous studies from the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, and Turkey have shown that women take on an especially high responsibility of caring for children with disabilities compared to men. And while we definitely have an economic range within these contributions, we received almost no submissions from parents who are economically struggling the most. Having the time and space to write, especially while raising kids with special needs, is a privilege. We work, fight for, and look forward to the day when that is not the case. My Baby Rides a Short Bus is meant as a partial antidote to the stories that misrepresent, ridicule, and objectify disabled kids and their parents. Here you'll find parents of disabled kids telling their own subjective stories with humor and grace. In lives when there's a new diagnosis or drama every day, we know that the stories these authors have written will provide a giggle, a rock to stand on, a moment of reality held far enough from the heart to see clearly. From professional writers to academics to novice storytellers, My Baby Rides the Short Bus collects experiences from parents at the fringe of the fringes. We hope you will enjoy it. Thank you.
Hello. How's it going? Yeah? All right. Okay, so I'm going to read my piece, which I need to sort of prelude it a little bit first. So I'm not a parent, I am a sister of my brother Sammy, who has brain damage, and I decided to interview my mom on the piece. My mom's first language is Spanish, so I thought interviewing her would be the best way to get her story there, and unfortunately, I can't do her accent at all, like at all, not even near. So if I sort of start slipping into some weird tongue accent, that's me trying to do my mom, but I fail and then I'll stop. So if I just seem like a little weird here, and I'm also going to be reading through it with like big chunks missing. Basically, this entire thing's not going to make sense. Just kidding. Okay, here we are. My mama drove the short bus. My mom, Magdalena Bueno, also known as Maggie Chapajev, came to the States in 1964 from Quito, Ecuador, at the age of 21. Here she met my father, Shevket Chapajev, a man who had only recently escaped communist Bulgaria. Soon they were married, and my mom was pregnant with my brother, Sammy Sadek Chapajev. Sammy was born with brain damage. I came into the story much later than all this. 10 years younger than Sammy, I never really had to take care of him the way my sister, mom, and dad did. The bulk of this responsibility fell on my mom, who had arrived in a country without the language, resources, or knowledge of what it meant to raise a handicapped kid. Recently, I interviewed my mom and her experiences. Mom, what were your first thoughts on coming to America? Oh my gosh, I came from Quito, where I never even saw a TV, to where my brother already had a TV. It was completely different, amazing. It was like a dream. How did you meet Dad? I met Dad when I was going to school for English. He was going with his friend, Hamid, and I was going by myself at that time. Somehow they started waiting for me outside. He must have just said hi because neither of us spoke English yet. Then he invited me to go out. We used to go to a place called Cafe Berlin for dancing and music. How long before you and Dad got married?
2 years.
And the next thing you know, you're married to this Bulgarian. I know! Jesus! At first I was thinking, what did I do? Different religions, different habits, different ways of living, different food. Everything was different. It was really difficult at first. Were you planning on having a child? No, it was too soon. I didn't know what I was doing. At that time, we didn't plan the way they plan now. Suddenly, I was pregnant, working, and living in this little apartment. What doctors did you go to while you were pregnant? Doctors? Oh, Sabrina, I still didn't speak the language. Daddy found this Yugoslavian doctor who didn't speak English either. I would tell Shevket what to tell him, and then they would speak Bulgarian to each other. But this man wasn't a doctor, he was a butcher, honest to God. He had no idea what he was doing. He just pretended he was a doctor for all these people from other countries. One time, we went for an appointment, and I saw him acting as a dentist for someone. He was people's dentists or their doctors. He would pretend to be anything you needed him to be. But I really believe he didn't know anything about anything. Can you tell me what happened when your water broke? I was working at home, and one old lady was going upstairs with a bucket full of wet clothes. I said, no, I'll do it for you. I took the heavy bucket, went upstairs, and saw that my water broke in front of her steps. But I was only 7.5 to 8 months pregnant. It wasn't time yet. I called Shevket to call the doctor, and the doctor said, don't worry about it. Just go to bed and stay there. Don't move. That was so stupid. If I knew better, Jesus, it makes me cry now. Daddy was working 2 jobs at that point, so he left me a sandwich and a glass of milk and went to work. And here I was with my contractions. I mean, you don't do that. Your water broke, you go and have the baby. I was like that for 2 days. I really believe that this is why Sammy is the way he is. When did you realize that something was wrong with Sammy? At the time I was pregnant, Martha, who is her good friend, was also expecting. Her son Ivan was born a month after Sammy. When Martha and I would get together, I would see that Ivan, being 1 month younger than Sammy, was already doing things that Sammy wasn't. If you gave Ivan toys, he would play with them. Sammy would just drop them. I went to a doctor and said, I think something is wrong with Sammy. And he said, you're just comparing him to everyone else. Sammy's just different. But then Sammy started having asthma attacks. They had to give him oxygen in the hospital, and we ended up in the ER so many times. One time he went to the hospital for asthma. He was probably 6 months old. And I asked the doctor, as long as he's here, can you make him some kind of tests? These days they do the tests the same day kids are born, but back then they didn't. I had to leave him overnight. It was so hard to leave the hospital without him. Soon they had the results of the test, and they called me to say, you better come to the office. It was a long drive, but Sammy and I went, and they told me, he's mentally retarded. He will never walk, never be toilet trained, and never be able to talk. They told me he would be just like a vegetable. When I started crying, the doctor said to me, don't cry. You can go give him to a state institution, go home and have another one. I took Sammy out from that office and started walking on some street in Chicago thinking, they are stupid, they don't know what they're talking about. I will make him walk, I will make him talk, he will be okay. It was so confusing because at that point I'd never seen a mentally retarded person. I never saw one in Ecuador, they probably hid them there. So I didn't even know what they meant by that. My mind was spinning, thinking, what will I do? Maybe I can take him myself to an island to live by ourselves so no one will make fun of him. I wanted to take him to an island because I was also thinking that if I went to some place and they didn't accept Sammy, they wouldn't accept me. I didn't know what to do. I went to buy a book. Idea. I was doing my best with English, but it was still hard to read. The main thing I understood in this book was that they say the number one thing for kids like Sammy was to have a schedule. To give them a routine. Well, I tell you, I made a big schedule that filled the entire wall. And this schedule wasn't by the hour, it was by every 15 minutes. We did everything by the schedule. What time he washed his hands, what time he watched Sesame Street, what time he ate breakfast, went to bed, what time he gets up, what time he brushed his teeth. Then one time I was feeding Sammy and suddenly it felt like he stopped breathing for a second. But I couldn't tell, was it Sammy or was I imagining things? We'd already gone to the emergency room so many times, and with the doctors constantly telling me that there was no hope, I almost started expecting something to go wrong. I took him from his chair and started screaming, "My baby's dying!" and ran downstairs for help. My neighbor was a nurse. She came out, looked at Sammy, and reassured me everything was okay. And it was. Nothing was wrong with him. At that time, I was going so nuts at the schedule. Things had to be so perfect, so precise. I really wonder if this did happen.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, and just to let you know, what I'm skipping over is the fact that they said my brother would never walk, talk, or be toilet trained. He does not stop walking. He's on his feet all the time, driving us crazy. He doesn't stop talking either. And in terms of being toilet trained, my mom did toilet train him, and but it took 7 years, but she did it. Skipping ahead. By this time, you and Dad had moved to a small house in Elk Grove, a suburb of Chicago. What was it like with Sammy moving there? I didn't know how other families would react. I was nervous they wouldn't accept us. They would call to invite me over for breakfast or coffee, and I was always lying, saying, "Oh, my baby's in the bathroom, my baby's sleeping." But when I finally introduced them to Sammy, they helped me so much. Judy and Mike, our neighbors, were the ones that told me I should put Sammy in a school. I didn't know they had schools for people like Sammy, but Judy and Mike helped me to put Sammy in Kirk. Can you imagine? He was going on the bus and I could relax a little. It was a relief for me and I could finally concentrate on Sophia a little bit, who was just a baby. One time someone said that the kids in the school were being mistreated. Someone told me the teacher was spanking them with a ping pong paddle. I was so angry, I thought, no way. I have to keep an eye on my boy. How will I do this, though? Then one day, the bus driver came to drop off Sammy, and it was a different bus driver than usual. I wanted the bus to say hello to all the kids, and I high-fived them and took Sammy out. I went back inside a little while later. I received a phone call from the bus company. It was Mrs. Davidsmeyer, the owner of the company. She had been driving the bus that day because the person who had supposed to had quit. She got on the phone and said, "Maggie, this is Mrs. Davidsmeyer, and we need people like you to drive the bus. You understand the kids. They like you. Would you like to drive the bus for Sammy's school?" I thought it was a great opportunity. If I drove the bus, I could keep an eye on Sammy's teacher to make sure Sammy wasn't being mistreated. But there was a problem. Sophia wasn't even 1 year old, and I couldn't leave her home alone. So I said to her, "Mrs. Davidsmeyer, I have a little girl." She said, "That's okay, you can take her with you." And can you believe it? They made a special chair for Sophia. It was a wheelchair, but it had hooks in it, so I could strap her in so she couldn't move. She wasn't even 1 year old. I remember that whenever I finished driving the bus route, I would put the blanket in the back of the bus and give her a bottle. Weren't you afraid of driving an entire bus full of handicapped kids? Oh my gosh, I was so scared. So scared. Of course, they trained me, but for the first time I drove, the bus was the worst. There was a kid in a wheelchair that would stay at school far away for the week, and I would have to drive him there on Monday and pick him up on Friday. So it was a Monday, and it was windy and raining. I could hardly even see the street. Sophia's in the back, and she's crying, and I can hear her. And suddenly I have to drive down this two-way street where the cars are coming right at me. Sophia's crying and crying, and suddenly the wheelchair that the kid is in somehow unhooks, and I feel him fall right on me, right on my back. And I'm crying, and Sophia's crying. We're in the middle of the street, and the wind and rain won't stop. And I was so scared. But I slowly pushed the wheelchair back with my back, pulled off the side of the road, and locked his wheelchair back into place. "Did you like driving the short bus?" "Oh, yes, we had so much fun. I used to get up and say, 'Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to play Name That Tune.' I would sing, 'La, la, 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 la,' and then suddenly someone would go, 'Strangers in the Night.' Oh, they were great. Sometimes I would say, 'Okay, ladies and gentlemen, today we are not going to Kirk Center. Today we are going to New York City.' I know, they would laugh. It was great to drive the kids. I drove the bus for 2 years, and I stopped when I was pregnant with you. And you were pregnant with me for a long time, right?" "Forever, honest to God." "When Sammy was about 9 years old, I was pregnant and expecting you. At about that time, we took him to a neurologist to have a chromosome test. The day after the test, the woman called me and said, 'Miss Chapajev, I'm so excited to tell you that I know what's wrong with Sammy.' I couldn't believe it. In all those years, no one knew why Sammy was this way. And this doctor was so excited that she was the one to tell me what was wrong with Sammy. She said he had an extra little piece in one chromosome, that his brain damage had something to do with his chromosomes. I remember asking her on the phone, 'What chances do I have to have another child like this? Because I'm pregnant right now, 6 months. She said, 'If I were you, I'd have an abortion, because you have a 50-50 chance.' And I said, 'You know what? That'd be murder.' And I didn't think about it for a second. I just hung up on her. Of course, after that, I was afraid to give birth, and I'm telling you, I was pregnant with you forever. You were due at the end of October, and you came in December.
The doctor understood psychologically I wasn't letting you go, and eventually was going to induce labor. When you were finally born, they took you for a chromosome test right away. It was a relief for me to know that you weren't handicapped. What was Sammy like when I was born? Well, of course Sammy didn't care for you. Sophia was okay, but there was no room for one more according to him. He was pulling your hair ever since you were little. You had four hairs, he was pulling them. You were always scared and crying. I would find you under the bed hiding from Sammy. I didn't know what to do. Before you were born, I could hold Sophia in one hand and Sammy in the other. But then I had to hold you, and of course I had to have Sammy's hand so Sophia would start to cry, "You don't love me anymore." It was tough for her. I told her one time, "Sophia, what's the best part of a sandwich? Bread is bread, but what makes a really good sandwich? What's in the middle? And you are in the middle." Oh my gosh, that was the best thing for her. She used to turn to me, smile, and say, "Mom, the sandwich." Sophia was so little. One time I saw that she was kind of sad and quiet. She asked me, "If there's a God, then why did he send Sammy?" I said, "If everything was beautiful and the same, it wouldn't be life. There have to be good and bad things in life. To appreciate the good things, God has to show us the bad things too. He chose us, our family, because he knows that we can help him in this job. He sent Sammy to our house because he knew our house would be the perfect house for Sammy, and we are helping him in this job. And I believe this." They didn't expect Sammy to live so long, did they? The doctors told me that 9 years old would be enough. They told me the most that he would make would be 19. So stupid. He's 41 now. You think Sammy is your angel? Yes. Yes, he is. Are you happy you had him? Yes, yes, I feel blessed with him. I believe I have a direct contact with God through Sammy, and I believe things happen for a reason. I completely avoid thinking what ifs, like what if Sammy was okay? I always took him exactly the way he is, and I really believe he's a special person. Sometimes I'm thankful he's not a little bit better because he's not conscious of the fact that he's handicapped. He just loves that song from Mr. Rogers, "I'm Different." The kitty cat singing, "I'm Different." It's a beautiful song. That's where I'm going to end right now. I deleted quite a bit, so you'll have to definitely get the book to finish reading it. Thank you so much.
Mine is also the condensed version, so, and it's called What I Said and What I Didn't Say. A few months back, my next door neighbor, Anna, mentioned that she was co-teaching a graduate level class in social work at Hunter College on autistic spectrum disorders. Since she felt it was important for her students to understand what kind of impact their work will eventually have from the client ed, would I be interested in speaking to them for maybe 45 minutes one evening? Oh, would I ever. A few weeks later, my husband came home a bit early, and I went downtown to talk to the class. I talked and talked and talked, and then I talked some more. I ran over my allotted time. I ran over by at least 20 minutes, probably a good deal more, and yet I still could not squeeze in all the things I so desperately wanted them to know. But I think I got most of it in there. Things like how dismissive it feels to have introduced yourself by name to the service coordinator or the social worker or the therapist or what have you, and still be referred to as mom throughout the meeting. Like how people look at my family and the assumptions and the projections begin. And yet when we start talking and demonstrate that we know what we're talking about with regard to our children's diagnosis and care, we can literally see them reassess us. Like how hard it is for us to get to all these appointments, and yet in all these years, no one has ever mentioned that we might qualify for transportation, or respite care, or who knows what else. And how even though it felt like a big relief rather than bad news to finally get an accurate diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome for my daughter 3 years ago, it was really, really hard to deal with the possibility of having not one but two special needs children after my son was referred for an evaluation this past winter. I talked about how, because their issues are not things that show up on genetic screenings or any sort of prenatal testing, I was unprepared. But even preparation can only take you so far. It's just like parenting neurotypical kids. You may think you know what's coming, but you don't really know. No one does. I talked about how this is my job now. How even as annoying as it is to have people tell me all the time, I don't know how you do it, as though I have the option to stop. I know that we are lucky that I am able to stay home and have this be my 24/7, full-time, completely unpaid, no benefits job. Never mind how I do it. How do families where both parents need to work do it? How do single parents do it? I am completely overwhelmed nearly all the time, and yet, other than the same household responsibilities that everyone has, this is all I have to take care of. I cannot imagine how much falls through the cracks for other folks, because it is always just one more detail to follow up on top of another, on top of all the other things that have to be done, and it's a child's welfare that is at stake. And yet, what are our options? Not to do it? This is one part of life that I feel is best left unexamined. I talked a tiny bit about culture and class and about how I don't bother with any of the support groups in the city because they tend to be full of upper middle class white families in Manhattan with whom, beyond the facts of our children's diagnosis, we have little in common. I talked about how my experience with parenting choices in general is the complete opposite of my experience with dealing with my kids' issues. Because of this whole semi-bohemian breastfeeding, cloth diapering willingness to let a toddler get down and dirty and really explore a playground set of values that we embrace, we were outsiders, culturally speaking, compared to our parenting peers in our Harlem neighborhood when my daughter first started receiving services. And yet, the further downtown we went, the more mainstream our parenting style seemed to be, despite the fact that my husband and I are Puerto Rican and Black, we're not white, nor are we upper middle class. And yet, it's the complete opposite with dealing with services. I simply have not got the resources those women have. And due to differences in race and class and culture, my frame of reference is not theirs. We may have similar kids, but it seems to mean dissimilar things for us. I talked about my daughter's food intolerances and her sensory issues and how finally last summer I stopped fighting her every single night and just allowed her to have the same two dinners over and over and over because I couldn't stand it anymore. This made dinner time somewhat easier, even though I was cooking two different meals almost every night, a thing my childless self swore I would never ever do. I talked about my son's ears and how he had tubes surgically inserted to relieve constant ear infections, and still, every time I slack on the homeopathic remedies, he builds up this head full of mucus and he starts pulling his ears again, at which point I remind myself to be grateful that at least he can hear us now, and, oops, I lost my place. At least he can hear us now, and I restart the remedies. I talked about how even though I am 99% certain that they both, but particularly my son, would be greatly improved by going wheat-free, right now, I simply cannot face it. Given my daughter's intolerances to any form of corn, rice, or artificial food coloring, to have one more staple ingredient eliminated from our diet is just more than I can do, even if it means no more eczema for her and no more ear infections for him. And then there's the question whether my kids would even be willing to eat the alternatives, given their extreme sensitivities to taste and texture. One of the other professors, not my neighbor, was very severe. You don't get respite care? Apparently, she literally wrote the book on respite care, at least the first one. You don't get transportation? Your daughter doesn't get her mandated CSE services as outlined in her IEP, and you never followed up? It felt very accusatory, like, what kind of slacker mother are you? But I very carefully chose not to hear it that way, even though it came uncomfortably close to what that little mean, whispery voice in my head tells me all the damn time. And instead, every time she said something like this, I would take a breath and turn my attention back to the class at large and say, hey, I'm not a social worker. I am just a parent feeling her way through the system. This is not stuff I ever knew about in my life before kids. I have no formal training. I have done a great deal of reading on my own, but in the end, it's all a trial by fire. The first time I heard about the availability of respite care or transportation was through other parents who are dealing with similar things. So every time I hear about something new, what I have to do is either find out about it on my own and hope I can figure out how to get it for myself, or go back to my service coordinator and say, hey, I heard about this respite care thing. Do we qualify for it? And hope that she can get accurate information for me about it. And it can be so damn hard to know when the experts have it wrong. And then I have to hope that the change is not going to overset our already delicate balancing act. I talked about how there is no aspect of our lives that this doesn't affect. How I don't even think about certain aspects of the accommodations that we've made anymore. Of course there are certain clothes that I simply don't even think about buying for my daughter because they'll be scratchy or distracting. Of course it takes two people to brush my son's teeth because he has such extreme oral defensiveness. Of course I don't bring my kids into supermarkets or any other large store if I can possibly avoid it, because between the fluorescent lighting and the too many things that are all different, each one brighter and shinier than the last and all of them crammed in together, my kids are almost guaranteed to flip out and tantrum. There are a million and one things that we just do without even thinking about it, because that's how life is for us now. I told them I didn't sign up for any of this when I got pregnant. I thought I was just having a baby. Then I talked about how this was a big night out for me because my husband and I rarely get to go anywhere because my kids are too much for the average teenage babysitter to handle. Our families are not really available for sitting very often, and most adult sitters in our neighborhood are looking for full-time or at least consistent part-time jobs, and they're not interested in my little bit here, little bit there needs. Sometimes just the offer of help is enough to stave off the deep feelings of isolation that this kind of parenting can cause, but that's rare. Increasingly, I feel as though I am drowning, not waving. Burnout, becoming depressed, and unable to do what must be done and failing my kids frightens me so terribly that I cannot allow myself to even think about it. Part of maintaining this balancing act is never, ever, ever looking down. So then I took questions, which I have to say, although I was very clear that I was willing to answer anything whatever that they might ask, please ask, don't be shy. They were very surfacey. It was like there was so much they didn't know, they couldn't ask good questions. Yes, I do have to explain my kids to other people a lot. However, because Asperger's syndrome doesn't have any obvious physical hallmarks, it's not in the way one might expect. Instead of, what's wrong with her? I get a lot of questions about why we're even bothering with all these appointments and services since, hey, their kids do that too, and, but your daughter is so smart, and she seems fine. Well, yeah, she seems fine. She is fine, in fact. At first glance, she certainly seems like a regular kid, a little quirky maybe, until she drops pep trow and pisses in the grass like a puppy, mama, in the middle of your wedding reception. Just like any other kid you know, until she will not stop talking about comic books or birthday parties or asking the same three questions over and over for hours on end, despite your best efforts to change the subject or distract her, and you find out what discussing something ad nauseum really means. Completely normal, she is, until you discover the hard way that the majority of movies and television shows marketed to kids are so overstimulating for her, given her hypersensitivity to any kind of dramatic tension, that trying to watch them will nearly always result in her huddled in a ball, terrified and weeping, and or a week of screaming nightmares. She seems fine until something happens and you realize she really isn't a neurotypical kid, just like I've been telling you. Her brother seems fine too until you realize that the various routines that he has organized his day around have locked you in as well. And unless you're willing to deal with the shrieking tantrums he throws when they're disrupted. Besides, at six and under, oddness can be kind of cute. After that, these kind of quirks can be a problem, and I am not willing to wait and see if it goes away on its own, as so many people seem to think we should. Maybe she'll outgrow it. Yeah. It is possible to learn how to navigate the social situations that are so hard for my daughter, or relax the rigid adherence to routines that they both cling to, but they will never find it natural or easy. Despite the services that they receive to help with these very issues, already other kids are starting to notice my daughter's differences, and there are some that are beginning to shun her. Difference can be good. Ostracism is not. The last student to raise her hand said, "This is very overwhelming." "Yes, it is," I answered. I had never realized quite how much so until just now telling all of you about it. I thanked them for the opportunity to speak with them, and I went home. The bus ride home was very peaceful, but I was keyed up almost to the point of mania for nearly a week afterwards. That night, I woke up somewhere between 2 and 3 in the morning, and I laid there for a long, long time thinking about all the things I didn't get a chance to tell them, like how other parents of kids with spectrum disorders can sometimes be all, my kid's a misunderstood genius. Your kid is just plain autistic. And how there are days when I feel that the strengths that come with this kind of diagnosis are so spectacular that they are worth all of the tantrums and the wet pants and the stigma. Or how fantastic it is when your kid finally connects, because so often they don't. I didn't get a chance to talk about how scared I am for my daughter because she is so deeply naive and unsophisticated. No matter how careful and mindful we are in our parenting, she could so easily grow into just the kind of prey on which certain sorts of human predators love to feed. I didn't tell them about how hard it is to be the one who has to show my child how to make and keep friends, given my own social anxiety. I didn't spell out the economics of having high-need kids and how the never-ending appointments can become so expensive so quickly and how there is always that nagging worry of, is our insurance going to pay for this? Will early intervention pay for it? Will CSE pay? Are we going to have to pay? Again? More? Will they even see us when our outstanding balance is already so high? Do I have the cab fare, the copay, the bus fare? Since I'm not earning any money, and it would appear that I will never receive another W-2, what does that mean for the future? I don't make Social Security payments anymore. After all these years of caring for my children, am I going to end up an old lady who lives on cat food, dented cans, and bruised produce? My kids are high-functioning, but will they be able to live independently? Balancing is not the only thing that requires a well-maintained safety net. I didn't tell them that I've spent the wee hours of more than one morning lying in bed wondering how and when to tell my daughter about her diagnosis. What to say, what not to say, how to say it, what it means. She's not yet 7. Will she even understand? I don't know. The results of my son's evaluation should be arriving in the mail any day, along with the card informing me of the appointment to go and discuss the results. More than likely, I'll have to have a similar conversation with him one day. Is practice going to make this any easier? It was only supposed to be a 45-minute talk. I didn't have the time or the words to tell these students even the tiniest fraction of what it's like to be the mother of special needs kids. The closest that I could come was to say, it's a lot like parenting neurotypical kids, only more so, much more. Really, what my husband and I do is not so different than parenting any child. You learn how they function best and you make it happen as well as you can. However, as with so many aspects of parenting special needs kids, you're doing the same things, but to the most extreme degree imaginable, and sometimes way beyond what you could ever have imagined until one day, there you are, balancing.
All right. So my piece in this anthology is called An Inadvertently Compelling Argument for National Healthcare in 5 Mutually Incriminating Scenes. And I'm going to start on scene 3, and I'm going to take my sweater off. This way. My daughter had her first seizure shortly after her 4th birthday. And the first 2 scenes are sort of me trying to figure out, like, when all these things start going wrong with the insurance and suddenly we're getting bills and we don't know why we're getting the bills. And, oh, my God, the bill's for $3,000. And, you know, is that something I'm responsible for? So scene 3. Enough time has elapsed that our heroine, the conflict-avoiding, procrastination-prone artist mother of the epileptic child, considers herself something of a hoary old vet, the type of person who could conceivably handle this sort of thing in her sleep. We find her in a royal snit. The pharmacist she bakes cookies for every Christmas has made repeated attempts to refill the not entirely effective prescription drugs the epileptic child takes 3 times a day, but the stonewalling insurance company will not approve the transaction. According to the labels on the now nearly empty bottles, the epileptic child is entitled to 4 more refills before her mother must go against her nature and bug the neurologist for another 6-month prescription. The greetings of the hardy automated white male and the less hardy automated Spanish-speaking female are by now so familiar that our heroine barely registers them, reflexively stabbing the appropriate buttons on her telephone when asked. Then, hardy automated white male, according to our records, that policy has been canceled. Our heroine. Scene 4. Some 15 seconds after scene 3. Majorly freaking, our heroine immediately redials, frantic in her desire to muscle past the prompts of the hardy automated white male and less hardy automated Spanish-speaking female. She rasps, "Representative!" every time she is asked to enter. "Representative! Make a selection or enter. Representative! Personal information." Finally, female representative number 207. "Hello, thank you for calling Sunspire Child Health Plus. My name is Debbie. May I..." Our heroine, on the verge of having a seizure herself, verifies her identity, then gabbles incoherently about a policy she claims has been canceled in error. She invokes epilepsy, as in serious, we're not playing here, epilepsy, for which three types of seizure-suppressing medication must be taken three times daily. Apparently, those medications have run out, and without insurance, she is incapable of procuring them in the quantities that will keep her daughter from suffering a mind-blowing game over seizure. Our heroine leans heavily on her theatrical training, suspecting that it might be the last best option for someone like her, who, despite a fairly privileged upbringing and a college degree, has no idea how the system works. Oh, fuck! Female representative number 207. "Mrs. Halliday, if it's all right with you, I'm just going to put you on hold for one moment while I check our records, see if we can figure out what's going on here." Our heroine. "Yes, please, soulless Caucasian singers. Do you know the way to San Jose? Whoa, 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 whoa." Female representative number 207. "Okay, Mrs. Halliday, I pulled up your daughter's file, and unfortunately, I am seeing that that policy was canceled due to non-payment." On our heroine sinks to her knees a la Willem Dafoe at the end of Platoon. "Oh my God, oh, but, oh God. Female representative number 207, stoic but possibly seething with offense at hearing the Lord's name taken in vain. "I can send you an application if you'd like to re-enroll." Our heroine, "Can we do that over the phone right now?" Female representative 207, "I'm afraid that's not possible, Mrs. Halliday." Our heroine, "I can give you my visa." Female representative number 207, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Halliday, but our system is set up in such a way that even if I tried to re-enroll you right now, the computer wouldn't let me. The best I can do is send you the application and have you return it to us in time for the beginning of the next billing cycle." Our heroine assumes the prawn position. "Oh God, oh God." Female representative number 207, "Now you should know that along with that application, we will also be requiring a check for the overdue balance on the canceled account, plus 2 months' payment on the new account at whatever the current premium happens to be." Our heroine, "But what are we supposed to do until then? She's got to have this medicine, and even with it, she has like 5 or 6 little seizures a day. She falls off the jungle gym at school. If she doesn't get it, she could..." Female representative 207, "Yes, that's why we recommend paying your statements as soon as you receive them." Our heroine, "I know, I'm so sorry, I fell behind. It's just, I had a lot on my plate recently. I mean, we were away, and then do you think maybe if I came by with a check?" Simultaneously, our heroine's interior monologue, "Fuck you, lady, if my kid has a seizure and dies, it's your fault. No, take that back. Don't even jinx yourself. Oh my God, I'm so fucked. I'm a danger to my own child. I'm a horrible, horrible, selfish moron. This nightmare, it's entirely my own fault. It's so typical." Female representative number 207, "We're in Bluebonnet Shoals. That's right outside Albany." Our heroine, there's not some office in the city where I could..." Female representative 207, "No." Our heroine's interior monologue, Shit, fuck. Simultaneously, our heroine, "Please, she's just got like 2 pills left before she runs out." Long, long pause. Female representative 207, Let me speak to my supervisor. Scene 5. 3.5 days and several dozen phone calls after scene 4. Hardy automated white male and less hardy automated Spanish-speaking female run through their customary spiels. Our heroine, the conflict-avoiding, procrastination-prone artist mother of the epileptic child, clings hollow-eyed to something resembling a yogic breathing regimen, wincing as the hardy automated white male reiterates that, according to his records, that policy has been canceled. Female Representative 214. Thank you for calling SenseBuyer. My name is Cheryl Case. Our heroine, I'm calling about my daughter. Her account was canceled because I screwed up on the bill, but I spoke with Debbie on Thursday, and she spoke with Mr. Thompson. He said that as long as I could get a check to you by today, the policy could be reinstated, which is really critical because she takes all the seizure medication for epilepsy. I was able to get the pharmacist to sell me a couple of pills to get us through the weekend, but female representative number 214 asks our heroine to verify her identity. Oh, yes, dutifully supplied. The account remains canceled. Oh, God. Okay. Our heroine, wild-eyed, frothing, but I sent the check on Thursday, right after I got off the phone with Debbie. Female representative number 214, you sent it to the address in Bluebonnet Shoals, not the P.O. box on the bill? Our heroine, yes, yes. Female representative number 214, okay, well, do you have the FedEx tracking number? Our heroine, bowels freezing with regret. I didn't send it FedEx. Female representative number 214, according to Debbie's notes, you were told to FedEx a check for the full amount for overnight delivery with the understanding that we needed to receive that check by today in order to reinstate the account. Our heroine, I know, but the lady at Kinko's said that since we're both in New York and the post office was just a block away, priority mail would probably be just as good. Female representative number 214. Let me get this straight. You were at a place where you could have sent it via FedEx, and then you decided to go to the post office instead? Our heroine, I know. Female representative number 214. So you sent it via USPS, priority overnight? Our heroine, no, just regular priority. Female representative number 214. Even though you understood that that check, absolutely no exceptions, had to be in our hands by Friday. Our heroine, she said it would be just as fast. Female representative number 214. Did you at least send it certified or request delivery confirmation? Our heroine, no, I used the automatic machine in the lobby. Female representative number 214, under her breath. Incredible. Our heroine, believe me, I'm kicking myself for not sending it FedEx. I mean, I guess I thought it would be a good thing to save $20 because I'm stupid. Defeated, our heroine stares at the cheap, boob-shaped overhead fixture in her cramped $1,400 a month living room, agonized that she is so immature as to have lapses during which her responsibility for her child's health is less of a priority than checking her email or pursuing some half-baked, arty whim. Would that the precious creature had never been stricken, that health was a thing that could be taken blissfully for granted until that day in the extremely far distant future when our heroine herself is painlessly and poignantly expiring on high thread count linens, surrounded by loving family and friends. Female representative number 214, you do understand that a huge exception was being made in your case. Our heroine, Lord Jesus, have pity on this miserable sinner. She knows not what she does. I know. Yeah, I know. It's my fault. I screwed up. Female representative number 214 sighs, murderously sick of dealing with incompetence such as this hippie ding-dong. All right. What did the envelope you mailed it in look like? Our heroine, arm hair prickling alert. What? female representative number 214. There's a chance that it might have been delivered this morning, but we get thousands of pieces of mail every day. Maybe it's sitting in a bin in the mail room. Our heroine, it was in one of those red, white, and blue flat rate envelopes. Female representative number 214. Great. I hope you don't have anywhere to be, because this could take a while. Our heroine, I can hold. Female representative number 214. There's no guarantee that it's there. Our heroine, with the adrenaline rush of a woman wrenching the roof off a car to free her infant from a flaming wreck. No, no, I know. Take all the time you need. Female representative number 214. No love in her voice. All right, please hold. An interval of nearly 20 minutes. Cue string heavy instrumentals of various soft rock hits. Our heroine psychs herself up. She must be like the mother puma, ready to hop on a Greyhound bus 4 hours north to Albany in order to sort through the insurance company's mail for them. She hopes security clearance will not be a problem. She'll take her driver's license. She hopes another mother will volunteer to pick up her kids from school, because there's no way she'll be back in time. She cringes to imagine how much a cab to Bluebonnet Shoals will run her, but whatever the cost, she's lost that privilege to bitch about that. Okay, her heartbeat is rivaling that of a hummingbird's. At last, female representative number 214. Grudgingly. Well, you're in luck. We found it in one of the last bins we looked in. Oh, cue offstage celestial choir. Oh, our heroine. Oh my God, thank you. Female representative number 214, you do understand that this was a one-time thing. If you fail to pay on time again, we won't be able to. Our heroine, determined to prove that she will do better, that she will never, ever fuck up again, that from here on out, all is going to be smooth sailing and conscious, timely effort. The margin for human error is all used up and thus permanently eliminated. I understand. I do. And it was my one get-out-of-jail-free card, and after that, no more. Thank you, thank you. And please tell Debbie and Mr. Toms that I say thank you from me, too. Female representative number 214, I'll reinstate your daughter's account as of today. It may take a few hours to go through. Our heroine scheming to mail cookies to the address in Bluebonnet Shoals. For one reason and another, she will not get around to actually doing this for another week and a half, and will worry that they will arrive stale. But she sort of knows that the recipients have cemented their opinion of her and probably wouldn't be too grateful even if the unsolicited treat had been FedExed straight from the oven. Oh my God, I can't thank you enough. Female representative number 214 disconnects without thanking our heroine for calling Sunspire. Our heroine collapses on the carpet and remains there until shortly before she is due to pick up her children from school. For once, she does not feel guilty about failing to use her child-free time in pursuit of some negligible artistic goal. And then there's a discussion guide. You don't have to answer these questions. You can just think about them and answer them tomorrow. How does the author's tendency to avoid conflict, procrastinate, and preoccupy herself with artistic goals of no discernible impact influence her ongoing negotiations with her children's insurance provider? Why might someone in the author's position not sign up for automatic bill pay? Why might the children's father balk at stripping the author of all duties relating to the children's health insurance? How many times in the last year have you heard the word seizure used in a humorous, non-epileptic context? Did you know Mark Twain had an epileptic child who suffered a fatal seizure on Christmas Day? Did you know that the title character in Carrie was partially based on an epileptic girl Stephen King knew in high school who died of a massive seizure in her 20s? The author has another character allude to her as a hippie ding-dong, albeit non-verbally. Is that an apt description? If so, why do you think she is relying on three different types of prescription medicine to semi-control her child's seizures, as opposed to herbs, crystals, and creative visualization? How does the author's nationality influence or define her experience? How might these scenes have played out prior to the advent of the automated phone system? Why are all the female representatives female? Might the author's attitude be a chronic reflection of the fact that she doesn't like to talk on the phone? Do you think the author has learned her lesson by the end of this piece? Would the author seem more sympathetic had she majored in business administration or something less frivolous than an archaic art form that rarely translates to a living wage? What if the author's child had leukemia or cystic fibrosis? What about autism, asthma, or a severe peanut allergy? What will happen when the author's child is no longer eligible for Sunspire Child Health Plus? Is that 18 or 19? It's not like a new insurer could deny her coverage based on a pre-existing condition, or could they? Do we trust the author to begin researching the answers to this question in a timely manner? Wouldn't it be totally awesome if the author's child's epilepsy spontaneously cured itself? Thank you.
That concludes tonight's program, but I wanted to turn it over to you guys if you have any questions about the book or for individually. Do you guys want to come up and join me?
Okay.
Safety in numbers. So does anybody have a question? Yes.
What have been some of your most helpful experiences with healthcare providers?
For one of us specifically?
Anybody?
I haven't had one. We're not covered. Yeah. They don't touch us.
When my son was first being diagnosed, this is going back 9 years, we had an occupational therapist. I don't know if that counts as a healthcare provider in that traditional sense, but she once said, therapy should be therapy and home should be home, and make sure that your child has a childhood, basically. So, you know, that was 9 years ago. That's a long time to get good advice, right?
Mm-hmm. Did you mean insurers or healthcare providers in general?
I'm studying to be a midwife. So, you know, doctors, midwives, nurse practitioners, things like that.
Let me change my answer then.
Okay.
I have had an awesome experience with the Kennedy Center up in the Bronx, the Rose F. Kennedy Center, named after the Kennedy sister that you don't see in the papers because she had issues. And they have been hands down the best people that they always know what they're talking about. Their information is always on point. There's nobody in there that I've walked out of there going, well, that was a waste of an hour and a half. Always good. Other than that, I've had crazy run around, and you don't want to hear about that. But they're my best.
Well, insurance-wise, for me, definitely that was a highlight of dealing with somebody who clearly didn't like me, you know, and was standing perhaps properly in judgment of me not paying this very important bill, but that she bailed me out anyway, which she didn't have to do. I mean, and that was a good lesson in, like, it isn't always this moment where the bells ring and the angels sing and this good-hearted good Samaritan will help you. This woman helped me and didn't like me. And then sometimes, like, it'll be some other thing where the medication isn't approved and it isn't my fault, and you finally get through to somebody after 5 hours of calling and worrying that you're not going to have the medicine, and you'll get some woman in Texas who's like, well, oh, God bless her, honey, and God bless you. And I was thinking, she only knew, you know? But it's like, it's nice to have those kind words. And that is true of healthcare providers as well. We had a hairy, hairy experience in a NICU with a wide range of interacting with different people in the medical profession, some of whom were excellent nurses with just terrible bedside manner, and the pediatrician who was randomly assigned to me, who did keep calling me mom. And I was just like, you know, it's just like how much just being referred to by my actual name would have changed things or made me trust him. But since then, I mean, we have a great neurologist, and I guess it takes like reading a profile about him on Christmas Day in the New York Times to go, hey, go awesome, he really is a good neurologist. You know? Like, I tend to like trust something when I sign up for it. My husband doesn't, so that's kind of a failsafe there. But, and I found out that, like, I didn't even know after the seizure, and our pediatrician, who's also wonderful, was like, well, I found one guy who's still open at 4 o'clock on a Friday to see somebody who he's never heard of, and he'll stay there, but take a cab, and we did. And I didn't even realize, like, he's the head of pediatric neuro-oncology. It took me about 3 years to realize the pediatrician thought she had a brain tumor, and that's why, like, we got sent to the head of pediatric neuro-oncology. And I found out in this article that our doctor had a 2-year-old child who died of a brain tumor, and that's, like, certainly he has enormous empathy for what the families are going through, and we are, like, the least emotionally needy in terms of what our child is going through compared to what his other patients' families go through. Like, we're small potatoes for him.
I just also want to add, I stopped going to developmental disability centers a few years ago because they're very depressing, and I just switched to a regular pediatrician because I couldn't take the experience. Every time I went to one of those centers, those clinics, like, it took me a week to recover, and I just decided it really wasn't worth it. I wasn't getting anything from there that I couldn't get somewhere else. So, you know, it's very institutional, and it's still very backwards in those places. So,
I just wanted to ask you guys, do you still feel that even with ADD and with a mental disorder, like having a parent with a mental disorder, do you find that a disability too? Like having a mom with bipolar or schizophrenia or having a child with ADD, do you still find that as a disability?
I think that's really up to the parent defines it as. I mean,
okay.
A lot of my friends are bipolar, you know, were diagnosed with that at some point, and a lot of them are mamas, and
right.
I never think about, and I can't say I don't think about their experience because, you know, I've been there when things have happened, but I don't think of it as something that's going to make them a less capable parent at all. I mean, never crosses my mind.
My mother is bipolar, and I have a mental disorder, but I have a son, and I don't think, like, I'm crazy, you know, I'm crazy, but like,
I think I'm a little crazy. So.
Yeah, and I also wanted the woman who talked about the autism, is I used to babysit a mild autistic boy, and now he's in high school, and he's able to walk alone, and walk with friends, and socialize, and I just wanted to say there's hope.
Oh, my daughter is extremely high-functioning. She goes to regular school. She's in a regular classroom. She's not in a special ed classroom. She is not... I get a lot of, why are you doing this? Because she appears on the surface like every other kid. So, that's why it's a spectrum. You get this diagnosis that says your kid is autistic. And you could be anywhere from here to there on that spectrum. And so your level of functioning on that from here to there, you know, you never know. She is now 8 years old. She's in third grade. She's going to have her first sleepover birthday party. You know, she's doing her thing.
Also, I wanted to mention I was referred as having Asperger's syndrome by a friend because I was pregnant and last trimester I didn't sleep, and he thought I had Asperger's because the sound was getting to me, and that was the lack of sleep for like 3 months. So people get all terms.
Anybody else?
Well, I really love what you, I mean, all of you were fantastic, but as a parent of a kid with Asperger's who's in mainstream situation as well. It's so related so deeply to everything you said. But also that I wanted to mention that I find that the labels themselves can be so limiting. And we, you know, one reason when I heard about, you know, contributing to this anthology, I thought I'm not out of the closet with my kid either, and I don't use the term Asperger's at home with him. We say, yeah, you're a quirky kid, and we love quirky. You know, quirky is who you are, and this is a good thing. But to define, if we called him Asperger's, he would be an Asperger kid. This would be his new label. This would be his new tick.
Right.
And the problem with labels is and boxes that they end up fitting in is that's what people have expectations for them to fit within that label. Just like we're always mom
right.
at the doctor's office or wherever we're at. the kid only fits within that box in terms of their expectation. And the fact is, they do learn how to walk and talk and get toilet trained if we don't have our expectations that they're only going to fit within those parameters. So
I haven't actually had the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been things where she said to me, oh, why is this so hard for me? Why can't I eat what my friends, you know, why? And I've explained it in the context of the moment. And one of the things that she hears a lot is everybody's brain works differently.
Right.
And so that's like the bottom line. It doesn't matter if you have a diagnosis, if you don't have a diagnosis, if you are straight down the middle average in every way, if you're neurotypical, if you're not neurotypical, everybody's brain works differently. And hers has given her some amazing strengths.
Yeah.
And then she's got these things that she really struggles with. And that's what it's all about.
For what it's worth, my son found this book at OT, mm-hmm. Called The Out of Sync Child.
I've seen that.
And he read it. He locked himself in the bathroom for several hours and read it. And then he found the authors on the internet and wrote to her a couple of years ago and suggested that she have chapters written by the kids and themselves. And he said, I'm an out of sync child. So he will also acknowledge that. And it's about sensory integration stuff. So you should look at it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else?
It's delectable.
That's it? Mm-hmm. All right, then Blue Stockings has plenty of books for sale, so I hope that you'll go home with one. And if anyone has any questions to follow up, you can email us at shortbusbook@yahoo.com. We try to answer everything. So thank you again. Cool.